This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Alone in America. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for being with us and spending part of your weekend here. Americans more than ever are spending the later part of their lives by themselves. Why are we aging alone? Also, more and more hotel guests are visiting for the lobby, not the room. We'll explain the trend. Also, the beer you drink may reveal your personality. Hear the differences between lager drinkers and ale drinkers. And recent studies find that kids don't bring us as much happiness as we think.
It was sort of like looking at the stock market in 1987. You know, as the birth of their first child approached, their reported happiness climbed higher and higher. And upon the arrival of the child, their happiness plunged, just like the stock market in 1987.
Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com tackles the question, do kids bring happiness? He's here later in the hour. Baby boomers are aging alone more than any generation in U.S. history, and the resulting loneliness is a looming public health threat. Census figures and other research show that about 1 in 11 Americans age 50 and older lacks a spouse, a partner, or a living child. That amounts to about 8 million people in the U.S. without close kin, the main source of companionship in old age, and their share of the population is expected to grow. Here's Wall Street Journal news editor Janet Adamy. Janet, this is unsettling.
It's interesting, Gordon. What we found is with the baby boomer generation, this was a generation that really prized individuality. They were more likely to get divorced, had fewer children than previous generations, and they had a spirit of individuality. The end result is that now that they're getting into their older years and they're retiring, they are more likely to find themselves living alone without close family and kin. Those are often the biggest supports in the later years, and we're finding that the rates of loneliness among baby boomers are higher than other generations, including the generation that's older than them, the silent generation.
Wow. No siblings, kids, nieces, nephews to be supportive? I don't understand what's happening.
It's those demographic factors. I mean, some of it is the way that society in general has evolved. You know, the institutions like civic groups, participation in organized religion, those things aren't as strong as they used to be. But for the boomers, it really comes down to some of these life choices that they made earlier that, you know, you were probably not top of mind when you're, you know, foregoing having as many children or you're getting a divorce earlier in life. The dynamic when you age, it becomes more problematic.
Wow. So you referenced religion. I believe the guy you opened the story with from Utah says he's even stopped going to church, and that was offered at least some sort of social stimulation.
Yeah, one of the most interesting findings is the relationship between health and loneliness. And there's a good bit of very strong research out there suggesting that it's not, you know, loneliness doesn't just make you feel kind of sad. It actually has concrete negative consequences for your health. Some of the research has found that being lonely is as bad for you as smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day or consuming more than 6 alcoholic drinks a day. It's even worse than being obese or physically inactive. So in the case of this particular gentleman, one thing that we find, these two things go hand in hand, is that when your health, when you get less healthy, it also becomes, you have a disincentive to go out and socialize. Wow. So in the case of Danny Miner, who's in our story, you know, he kind of became a negative cycle where his legs started to ache, his shoulders ached, and so he wasn't doing this stuff as much, and then he ended up spending more time alone and becomes more lonely.
Goodness. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal news editor Janet Adamy. She's in the Washington, D.C. Bureau with a fascinating piece entitled The Loneliest Generation, Americans More Than Ever Are Aging Alone. How much does money have to do with this? Are they short on funds to, travel or go out and do something?
Well, what we find, that the real financial impact comes through the Medicare program that takes care of the elderly. There was a pretty good study from AARP and some Harvard and Stanford researchers that came out last year that found that the lack of social contacts among older Americans costs Medicare $6.7 billion a year. That mostly that is from spending these isolated seniors spend more money on nursing facilities, and then when they get hospitalized, they are more expensive in the hospital. So I think the real financial impact comes from what you have to the system. It's not just the seniors themselves who are bearing this cost. It's really, you know, essentially the taxpayers who are paying into Medicare.
Wow.
Which is what makes this a public health problem. It's not just, I think people often think of this as these individual cases, but because of the financial impact, it's really more of a national problem. And we're seeing more attention brought to this. The Trump administration is trying to look at a way to use faith-based partnerships to better connect with, to better tap into seniors. I mean, there are certainly many seniors still do go to church, and the idea is those seniors are going to those churches. Let's have those churches be the first point of contact in reaching out to these people.
You know, another thing that jumped out at me in your story, you began the one paragraph by saying, among the most likely to lack close kin are college-educated women.
That's right. This is kind of an interesting finding because I think it has to do with this sort of the woman who comes after that, who is she was an executive here in the Washington area, and she's found that, you know, now that she's in her late 60s, she's had a real hard time finding a new partner.
Thanks, Janet. That is Wall Street Journal news editor Janet Adamy. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. The length of time the United States spends on presidential campaigns is unreal. Some may argue unhealthy, and for many of us, unbearable. Columnist Jeff Jacoby at the Boston Globe has a way to make them shorter. Jeff, anything to help, because they're awful.
Campaigns are awful, and they're more awful in America than they are almost any place else in the world. You go to any democracy, and campaigns for national office, for prime minister, for president, whatever they have in those countries, never last more than a couple of months at most, sometimes not even more than a few weeks. And yet here we managed to make our presidential campaigns last for 2 years or more. And we always complain about it. Most Americans will tell pollsters long before Election Day 2020 that they are sick and tired of the campaign, that it's gone on too long, that they're fed up with it, that they don't see why it has to last forever. And it occurred to me that one big ingredient that explains why our campaigns have gotten so long is this strange phenomenon of Iowa and New Hampshire going first in the primary campaign. You know, Iowa always has the first caucus, New Hampshire always has the first primary. And it's customary for critics to complain about those two on grounds of diversity. They say Iowa and New Hampshire aren't typical of the country as a whole. They're too white, they're too rural, they're too wealthy, all of which may be true. That's not the issue that I focus on in my column today. Yeah. Instead, the point that I try to make is that because the politicians all know that Iowa and New Hampshire go first, they know where the campaign will begin. And so they have pushed further and further and further back the point at which they start campaigning. So we're already seeing stories of candidates, would-be candidates, presidential hopefuls, people thinking about becoming presidential hopefuls, flying up to New Hampshire, flying out to Iowa, starting to make the rounds, going to the meet and greets, yeah, introducing themselves to voters. This is only 2018. The presidential term isn't even half over yet. And here we're already getting coverage out of New Hampshire and Iowa. And the thought that I had was that whatever other reasons there may be to question the validity or the wisdom of having the same two little states always go first, the bigger problem is that because everybody knows they go first, the candidates start campaigning there that much earlier. And we have effectively moved back the start of our presidential campaigns far beyond the point that anybody would rationally have chosen. So my suggestion is that we should end this monopoly, break the stranglehold that Iowa and New Hampshire have on the presidential voting process, come up with a better system, and I suggest what I think might be such a system in the column today. But the main goal isn't because there's anything particularly wrong with Iowa and New Hampshire, but rather, if you always know where the next presidential campaign will begin, that's a huge incentive to start campaigning there much, much, much too early.
That's a good point. I'm speaking with Jeff Jacoby, Boston Globe columnist. He's written a piece entitled, If Iowa and New Hampshire Didn't Always Go First, presidential campaigns would be shorter, and he's come up with a solution. So the fix involves somewhat of almost like a poll, as you were explaining. Set that up.
My idea is to have a random drawing every 4 years. The two major parties, and I guess whatever other parties would be holding primaries every once in a while. Libertarians have a primary. The Greens have a primary. So let whatever political parties are going to be having primaries meet once every 4 years. I suggest doing it on New Year's Day of the election year, no sooner. And the key point is that it wouldn't be done any sooner. Unlike, for example, the announcement about where the presidential nominating conventions will be, you don't do it a year in advance or 2 years in advance. Rather, you do it just a month or so, maybe 2 months, before that first primary or first caucus will be held. So my idea is New Year's Day 2020, the Democrats, the Republicans get together to make a big hoopla. It could be like the Powerball or, the lottery drawings. And they will choose from a field of, let's say, the 20 smallest states. You could take the 10 smallest states by population, the 10 smallest states by area, and have a drawing. Decide which will be the two that will go first that year. And put those 20 states into the mix. The parties have make a big, a big hoopla about the drawing. And outcome, I don't know, it'll be New Mexico and Vermont.
Yeah.
And then only then would the candidates and the would-be presidential staffers know where they have to go to start campaigning, to do that kind of retail, street-level, grassroots campaigning that people do like, for good reason, Iowa, New Hampshire. But the point is, they would only be starting to do it a few weeks, maybe at most a couple of months before that first primary or that first caucus. They wouldn't be starting 2 years before. And it seems to me that this is one simple reform which not only would be fairer because it would give other states a crack at going first, but it would also be healthier because it would end this long, drawn-out, excruciating process that we've gotten ourselves trapped into of campaigning for president forever.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Jacoby, columnist at the Boston Globe. It's 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Learn about the best state to start or grow your business at michiganbusiness.org. Walk into a hotel lobby and you may notice something unexpected. People. Not people checking in or waiting for someone to arrive or hustling to the elevator. No, people sitting, working, and socializing. In the past handful of years, hotels have started to create lobbies and common spaces that are a destination in themselves for both guests and locals. It's a story by Talia Minsberg at the New York Times. Talia, what's up here?
For one thing, a lot of hotels have said that the reason they want to open their spaces to locals and people who are traveling and working is an energetic hotel is a more exciting hotel. If you walk into a hotel lobby and you see a lot of people working there, it's a cool place to be. So they say it's great for word of mouth. If you're co-working in a hotel that you've become a fan of, you're more likely to tell a family or friend who's coming to visit that it's a great hotel to stay in. And it also does help at some point to the bottom line. You know, if a lot of people are spending an hour or two here or there, they're probably buying a coffee, maybe buying a sandwich, but it's all about getting really an energetic feeling in hotel lobbies and in hotel common spaces that previously was just not there.
Wow. How are hotels, marketing themselves or dressing things up to make it a friendly, say, community workspace?
Well, one of the first things that the Ace Hotel in New York City did is put outlets everywhere, which sounds like a really little thing, but if you walk into a coffee shop, you can tell really quickly whether they're places that want you in or out or places that want you to stick around and work. If you can't find an outlet, there's a good chance they don't want you there for more than an hour or two. But at the Ace Hotel, you can find outlets everywhere. There are long tables with lots of different chairs. There's some good light. There are lots of comfy places to sit. It's everyone I spoke with said it was a combination of the right furniture, the right lighting, and everyone said outlets.
No kidding. Is this happening at mostly high-end hotels?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think to some extent hotels are kind of acting like hostels in the way in which they want to create common spaces that people want to spend time in. But I would say the brands I spoke with are looking to attract both business travelers and locals who are maybe artists or freelancers. So the hotels that I would point to are the AC Hotels by Marriott. There's a very interesting hotel called Zoku in Amsterdam that is focusing on creating a space for freelancers and artists, not only those who are traveling and those who are staying at the hotel, but those who actually, they created a space for people who co-work to actually live there for a month or months at a time. So it's all across the board in terms of different hotels, boutiques, big brands, small brands, fancier, less fancy.
How about that? We're speaking with Talia Mintzberg, Senior Editor of Special Projects at the New York Times. She's written a piece about how hotels have started to turn their lobbies and common areas into like WeWork gathering places, attracting both guests and locals. Speaking of WeWork, do they feel competition here?
That's a good question. I would say I wouldn't expect they feel too much competition. WeWork is a massive company. They have spaces all around the world. I feel like the hotels that are doing this, they want to just create another space for fans of co-working to sit down and get some work done. I wouldn't necessarily think WeWork is feeling really threatened. The thing about WeWork that hotels can't guarantee is at WeWork you can reserve desk space, conference rooms. At some hotels, they actually are moving more towards WeWork, in that some hotels are creating spaces that you can reserve a phone booth or you can reserve a meeting room. Of course, that's not free. They do charge for those services, generally speaking, sitting in the lobby, cheap, free, no cost.
What about keeping out, say, the riffraff?
That's not actually an issue that anyone has ever spoken about. They say they want people to come in. If they buy a coffee or a sandwich, great. If not, hey, it's a free space to get some work done. There are bathrooms. That's another thing people mentioned, it makes it a little more of a welcoming space if you know there's a restroom nearby.
Talia Mintzberg at the New York Times. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Dell's dedicated small business advisors give you tech advice and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. And now's the time to save on select business PCs with 8th-gen Intel Core processors until the end of the year. Maximize this year's budget and find the right tech solution for your business. Plus, get free shipping on everything. Visit Dell.com/businessdeals or call 877-BUY-DELL to talk to a Dell small business advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, do kids really bring happiness? A new study may surprise you. Also, why you should check Twitter before naming your kid, and how your preferred beer reveals your personality traits. Well, that story in about 20 minutes. The strains and limits on the country's caregiving system are especially acute in rural and non-metropolitan areas, where one out of four Americans 65 and older live. Around 65% of areas short of health professionals are rural or partially rural. Those numbers are from the Health Resources and Services Administration. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's hard enough for the elderly to get to appointments and stores when they live in urban areas. It's even more difficult in rural areas. And the problem is getting worse with more seniors living in non-metro areas. Claire Ansbury of the Wall Street Journal has written about this and joins us now. Claire, what kind of population numbers are we talking about?
About 10 million adults who are 65 and older live in rural areas. And that's about one in four of that population. It's quite substantial. I mean, rural, you can have rural meaning small density. Some rural areas are closer to metropolitan areas. But all in all, those areas will have fewer resources because the less dense population. And people will be further away from specialists like cardiologists and audiologists and oncologists.
How has the family dynamic changed this as well?
Well, especially in a lot of these agricultural areas, they haven't really recovered from the recession. And, in 2009, there was a lot of people moving out of those areas. So families, the adult children, had to move to look for jobs. And so that has made those counties, those rural counties, smaller, and the percentage of older adults living in them greater than urban areas. And also, you know, the adult children who remain in those areas, they often have to travel further for their own jobs. So, you know, they are just busy with their own lives and traveling for their work. You see that in urban communities, too, where the kids are busy with their jobs and their families. But in rural areas, you have the distance of, it's just harder to get things done, even to run errands and things. So it's all time consuming.
So, Claire, who is helping the elderly in rural areas?
Well, you have a lot of communities and volunteer groups and church groups just kind of trying to do it on their own. And that is, you know, the local communities know the needs, but I tell you, they are stretched themselves. And there are some federal programs, some national programs, like the National Family Support. It's a National Family Caregiving Support Group, and it's a federal program that provides free respite care for a limited number of hours a week to people who qualify. But you have in some of these really rural areas, like out in the middle of Wyoming, people saying, you know, we have the funds, we just can't get somebody to travel 60 miles to visit somebody for 4 hours. So it's really a mix of, you know, federal, state, but a lot of it is on the ground local, and people are trying to do as much as they can, as they always have, sort of neighbors relying on each other. But it's just that the population is getting bigger, and, you know, the chronic needs are greater, too. In rural areas, there's more complicated illnesses, higher rates of heart disease and diabetes. So, you know, that population has greater needs, too.
We're speaking with Claire Ansbury of the Wall Street Journal. Claire, your story was interesting in that you talked about the role of pharmacists in a lot of these communities.
Yeah.
They are the only healthcare provider. What is happening?
Yeah, that surprised me, too. Something like 2,000 rural communities, the pharmacist is the only local healthcare provider. You know, there's not the rural areas and the partial rural areas, of they comprise 65% of the health professional shortage areas. You don't get a lot of specialist doctors living in those rural areas, and a lot of the rural hospitals, they aren't always profitable, and they close down. So there's just a whole shortage and a whole dearth of support, both the informal support of family, neighbors, caregivers, and the formal support of the healthcare professionals, and also just paid caregivers such as personal aides, home health aides. There's just not as many.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansbury. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Do kids bring us happiness? If you believe the studies, the answer is generally no. Studies offer conclusions based on broad averages here. Your experience could be entirely different. Moreover, it may be that children give special meaning to our lives, but that isn't getting captured by the questions that researchers ask. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com has stepped up to tackle this debate. Jonathan, you're a brave soul.
No doubt about it. The idea that children may not bring happiness is a touchy one. People want to believe that when you have kids, that they're going to greatly enhance your life. But the research suggests otherwise. The first time I ever came across the research about children and happiness, it was a fascinating paper that looked at the reported life satisfaction of mothers and fathers as they approached the birth of their first child. And it was sort of like looking at the stock market in 1987. You know, as the birth of their first child approached, you know, their reported happiness climbed higher and higher. And upon the arrival of the child, their happiness plunged, just like the stock market in 1987. Within 3 or 4 years, their reported life satisfaction was below their long-term baseline. The birth of their children, contrary to what they had imagined, had dramatically reduced their life satisfaction.
Wow.
Now, I'm not saying this is true for everybody.
Yeah.
I'm Not saying that kids don't enhance your life over the long term, but certainly in the short term, in those initial years, having kids is not good for your happiness on average.
Oh, my goodness. What is it? What'd you write? Like $250,000 to raise just one of them these days, right?
Yeah, that's the figure from the Department of Agriculture. To raise a child through age 17 in a middle-class family costs something like $250,000. And that's even before you start to deal with college costs.
Oh, wow.
You know, you send your kid to a state university, you know, that's going to cost you $85,000. You send your kid to, you know, Harvard or Princeton or Yale or Cornell these days, wow, you know, you're probably looking at $260,000.
Mm.
Raising kids is not cheap. Now, this is not a reason not to do it, but you should realize that not only are they expensive, they are not priceless, they are expensive, but also in the short run, they probably will not help your happiness.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of the website HumbleDollar.com, and he's asking, do children bring happiness? What about calling them a huge investment, as you do in the story?
Yeah, again, you know, people didn't like the idea that we're going to put, you know, a dollar sign next to having a child. And I should hastily add, I have two children and two stepchildren. So, you know, I am not some heartless, childless New Yorker. I have been through this, and I have spent the money. Children are an investment, but I would argue that they are an investment in long-term happiness. I mean, in the short term, birth of a child will not boost your happiness. Having teenagers will probably not boost your happiness. Teenagers are, you know, basically surly terrorists. But once they are adults, children are a delight. I mean, you know, three of my four kids are adults at this point, and spending time with them is a huge source of happiness.
Yeah.
I'm hoping in the near future to have grandchildren, and all the evidence suggests that having grandchildren is also a huge source of happiness. Children are a long-term investment, but in the short term, they may not pan out.
Wow.
In terms of happiness.
As Jonathan says, the grandchildren, you can give back kind of at the end of a visit, right? They don't cost you anymore. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Today's millennial parents have either lost their minds or deserve credit for being forward thinkers. Apparently, the internet is the new stomping ground for naming your kids as parents try to reserve Twitter and Instagram handles as well as buy up domain names. It's a story by Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch. Katie, what's going on here?
So I spoke to a number of parents who said they check social media before naming their kid. One woman, she's a San Francisco mom. She actually wanted to name her daughter something, and but she looked for the Twitter handle to see if it was available before she chose the name. Now, she chose the first name, and she was going to stick with it no matter what. But the middle name, she just wanted to start with an A, and it was up in the air. And she went through names like Ava and Anne for the middle name, and she saw that full name on Twitter was taken for those, and so she changed her kid's name. And she said, you know what, this is what I want. My child is going to have a digital footprint in this world, which she's right. And so I wanted to make sure I got the Twitter handles. I wanted to make sure I got the social media handles for that kid because they are going to be on these platforms. And that's my thinking.
Wow. That's crazy. It made me think, you know, a lot of times we have good explanations or stories as to why we have the middle name we do. Right. So if yours is going to be dictated by Twitter, like you could wind up like trying to explain like why your middle name is like X percent sign dollar sign Kayla
right.
or something.
Right.
This sounds like you could be forced into a really weird situation.
Right. Yes. Yes, indeed. A lot of people I spoke to, I asked a dozen or so experts what they thought of this, and most of them thought this is kind of ridiculous. But listen, I did have a solid handful who said, okay, maybe not checking Twitter, maybe not checking Instagram for the name, but it's not a bad idea to get your kid a domain name. I spoke to this 30-year-old woman who was pregnant, and she had already bought her kid domain name.
Wow.
And a lot of people said that actually was a smart idea because, you know, everybody's going to have a website in the future, I guess.
Jeez. We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch. She's written a piece entitled, Why You Should Check Twitter Before Naming Your Kid. The thing I thought about this, too, is like the technology and social media seems to change so quickly these days. Perhaps by the time your kid is old enough to appreciate that special email address or Twitter handle, could be brand new social media out there that you haven't caught up with.
True. And I think for these people, they will keep up with it. As soon as they hear about a new thing, they're going to get that domain name too, or the Twitter handle or the Instagram handle or whatever. For them, it's important. And, you know, I don't know that I would do this, but it maybe isn't the worst idea, I must say, because it's true. Maybe these will change, but maybe they won't. And it might not be the worst idea for you to have the, you know, the website with your kid's name.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch. Reminder, by the way, that we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well, at Gordon Deal. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. The beer you drink may speak volumes about your personality. If you're staying in this weekend, you enjoy a good documentary, and you value arts over sports, then chances are you're an ale drinker. According to new research, a survey was conducted by OnePoll on behalf of Founders Brewing Company. Lager drinkers, according to the survey, are more likely to describe their ideal Saturday night as going out with friends, while ale drinkers lean more towards curling up on the couch and watching TV. Also, lager drinkers report higher stress levels than ale drinkers. But despite that, ale drinkers are the more likely bunch to say they're happy with their job and leading a fulfilling life overall. Lager lovers also tend to spend more time worrying about their future than ale drinkers, but they are more confident and more likely to love meeting new people. The survey also revealed that the best time to have a beer, or beer o'clock as they say, is 6:31 p.m. on a Friday. One other finding, by the way, beer drinkers are set in their ways. The average beer drinker has not switched up their favorite beer in 4 years. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.